KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. More than 100 migrants were sent to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba by the Trump administration. Now the ACLU is suing to make sure those migrants get lawyers. More on that this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. When the Texas power grid failed during a massive winter storm 4 years ago, state leaders vowed they would never let it happen again. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We take a look at how Texas has changed and what new challenges have arisen. Also, I speak with the husband and wife duo behind the band War and Treaty. They are part of a growing number of black artists embraced by Nashville's country music machine. It is Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. On this day in 1899, mechanical voting machines were approved by Congress for federal elections. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. NPR has learned that many federal workers are being let go from a variety of federal agencies. That's from the Education Department to the agency that safeguards U.S. nuclear weapons. Dozens of people have been fired from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. NPR's Laurel Walmsley has more.
According to several current staffers, between 70 and 100 staff were terminated at CFPB on Thursday evening. Earlier this week, dozens of other employees at the Bureau were fired. The most recent firings targeted term staff, who have contracts for a set length of time. Two letters shared with NPR said the employees' jobs were being terminated due to President Trump's executive order that outlines Elon Musk's plan to downsize the government. CFPB staff are hearing talk that wider cuts will happen soon. Republicans have long criticized the Bureau as being too heavy-handed in its regulation. Consumer advocates warn that a gutted CFPB will mean Americans are left vulnerable to financial abuse and fraud. Laurel Walmsley, NPR News, Washington.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been sworn in as the nation's newest Secretary for Health and Human Services. He had been fiercely opposed by Democrats who cited his years of work spreading conspiracy theories about vaccines. Kennedy opposes vaccine mandates, but he says he won't stop people from getting one if they want.
I'm not going to take away anybody's vaccine. If people are happy with their vaccines, they ought to be able to get them.
He spoke on Fox's The Ingraham Angle. Louisiana will no longer promote mass vaccination in that state. The Louisiana Surgeon General says his agency encourages patients in Louisiana to talk about vaccines with their providers. Separately, a measles outbreak is growing among children in West Texas. At least two dozen people are ill. None of them was vaccinated. Ukraine says a Russian drone struck the Chernobyl nuclear power plant today. It hit the radiation shelter protecting a damaged reactor. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv that Russia is calling Ukraine's accusations a provocation.
The strike caused a fire that Ukrainian firefighters were able to extinguish. Ukrainian authorities say radiation levels have not increased. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky posted surveillance video from the plant showing the moment the drone struck the concrete and steel structure. Speaking to reporters in Munich, he said the damage was significant. He says he believes the attack was a sign of hostility from Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia does not attack nuclear infrastructure. Chernobyl is the site of the world's worst nuclear accident. An explosion there in 1986 sparked a health emergency across Europe. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The new Environmental Protection Agency administrator says he will try to claw back about $20 billion in certain grants. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin says this is for clean energy projects that are focused on disadvantaged communities. Republicans say the grants are actually part of a slush fund. Residents of Los Angeles are recovering after a winter storm system dropped as much as 5 inches of rain. Among the areas hardest hit are Pacific Palisades and Altadena. Steve Futterman reports they're still recovering from last month's wildfires.
There were some close calls. An L.A. County fire employee had his SUV pushed into the Pacific Ocean by a mudslide. He was rescued. All day long, people were on alert. Ariel Cohn of the National Weather Service.
There will be the potential for very severe debris flows to occur.
At times, there were torrential rains. Streets were flooded. Cars were trapped by mud and had to be abandoned. Some homes and businesses sustained damage. But for the most part, the big fears of massive and deadly debris flows didn't happen. The Southern California area is not home free yet. The mountains and foothills in affected fire areas remain saturated, and there is still the potential for mudslides. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The video sharing app TikTok is back. Apple and Google have restored it to their app stores. That's despite a new federal law banning TikTok. But new U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi says she's not going to enforce that law. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The U.S. has sent more than 100 migrants to a detention center at Guantanamo Bay. Now the American Civil Liberties Union is suing, saying those migrants have been cut off from the outside world. No lawyers and no contact with family. We have more on the ACLU's lawsuit coming up. But first, world leaders are gathering in Munich for an annual global security conference. Among key agenda items is ending Russia's war on Ukraine. In recent days, however, many of Europe's leaders, including Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, have been expressing concerns about being left out of conversations between Russia and the United States to bring the fighting to an end. For more on this, we've called Jeff Rathke. He's president of the American-German Institute at Johns Hopkins University and a former deputy chief of staff to NATO's Secretary General. He joins us from Munich. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
You know, you've been to the Munich Security Conference many times, and I understand that this year's conference just got underway, but what's the mood there so far?
There is a sense of alarm and trepidation, Michelle, and that is best expressed by something one European official told me this morning. I asked him where his alarm bell was ringing, and he said on a scale of 1 to 10, it's at a 15.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's because this is the week where the iconoclastic, disruptive foreign policy ambitions of the Trump administration are actually taking shape and turning into, you know, real actions. President Trump's call with Vladimir Putin a couple of days ago, the speech of Vice President Vance in Paris, the defense secretary in Brussels. And so what Europeans are seeing take shape is an American policy that doesn't necessarily consult with them in advance, for which Europe is really unprepared.
Is there any consensus among the delegations from Europe about how to work with their American counterparts?
Well, there's one bottom line for all of them, and that is they recognize that Europe needs to devote more resources to defense and that they need to take on greater responsibility for their own security. Now, that may sound familiar because we've been hearing that for many years. And at many iterations of this Munich Security Conference, we've heard people say that they've had a wake-up call. Now, the question is, this year, will it really lead to people waking up and taking actions that will address the situation?
So let's talk about Ukraine specifically. A lot of European leaders like to say no deal about the war in Ukraine can happen without Ukraine at the table. I've got a couple of questions about that. But first, what are they prepared to do to make sure Ukraine is at the table?
Yeah. Well, what European leaders have started talking about is the possibility of a significant increase in resources devoted to Ukraine. In other words, to make up for the dwindling U.S. support, which is already in decline. And so the question will be whether they can put meaningful numbers on the table that will strengthen Ukraine's position as President Zelensky approaches these negotiations about bringing the war to an end. Will he feel confident that he's got the weapons, the financial resources, and the political backing to defend Ukraine's sovereignty?
There are these comments from the Trump administration about what Ukraine might have to concede. How is that going over?
Poorly. This is an instance where Europeans think the United States has given away much of the store before negotiations even start, whether talking about Ukraine's future relationship with NATO or territorial concessions or the nature of any kind of peacekeeping or foreign military force that would enforce a ceasefire. All of those things have already been conceded in one way or another by the United States, and that has left the Europeans quite frustrated.
So is there any leverage at this point? I mean, if the Europeans want to avoid President Trump dealing directly with Russia's President Putin or to intervene in what they consider already to be concessions that are unwarranted and unwise, what can they do? Is there any leverage?
Well, I think the leverage they have will be directly correlated with their ability to mobilize in the short term significant new resources, whether that's military assistance, financial assistance to keep the Ukrainian government running, civilian assistance to deal with the consequences of war. If they can step that up in the near term, then that will affect the positions President Zelensky takes at the negotiating table, and it might also lead to the Europeans being involved in those negotiations, which is something right now the United States is not talking about at all.
That's Jeff Rathke. He's president of the Johns Hopkins American-German Institute. Mr. Rathke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The U.S. government has not publicly identified the migrants it has sent to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
At least 112 people have been flown there in about the past week. Now a group of immigrant rights and legal aid organizations led by the American Civil Liberties Union is demanding that the Trump administration give those migrants access to lawyers.
NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has read the lawsuit that lays out those demands and joins me now. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning, Layla.
Okay, so these groups are suing the government. What does the suit say?
It says that ever since the migrants were shipped to Guantanamo, they've been held, quote, incommunicado without access to attorneys, family, or the outside world. And the lawsuit alleges this isolation is not a coincidence, that the point of flying these migrants to a remote Caribbean island is to make it especially difficult for them to communicate with lawyers, lawyers who could explain their legal rights and possibly challenge their detention. Here's something that the lead attorney in the lawsuit, Lee Gallant of the ACLU, said to me.
One has to wonder if they're doing it so they don't have access to counsel, so that they can be held without rights, and so that the government can have these photo ops.
And by photo ops, I'm assuming he's referring to the recent pictures we've seen of handcuffed men being loaded on and off military planes.
Correct. Those images were released by the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security. And the ACLU says some of the migrants' family members learned their relatives had been sent to Guantanamo because they saw them in those photos.
Wow.
They recognized a brother or a son. And now several of those family members are plaintiffs in this legal case.
What exactly is the lawsuit asking for?
It wants lawyers to be able to go to Guantanamo and meet with the migrants, But the suit acknowledges that traveling there will be arduous, will be hard to get to. So it asks that, at a minimum, attorneys be allowed to communicate with the migrants by phone or video conference or email. The ACLU lawyer, Gallant, points out that the suspected foreign terrorists who've been held for up to 2 decades at Guantanamo do have access to lawyers.
These immigrant detainees are now being held in a situation with less rights than even the alleged enemy combatants.
What's the U.S. government saying in response to this?
So, Leila, our colleague Jimena Bustillo, who covers immigration for NPR, got a statement from Homeland Security spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin that says there is a, quote, system for phone utilization to reach lawyers, but no additional detail was provided. And several of the migrants' relatives say they've repeatedly called ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to get information about their family members, but no success. And by the way, the DHS statement also said this: if the American, all caps, Civil Liberties Union cares more about highly dangerous criminal aliens, including murderers and vicious gang members, than they do about American citizens, they should change their name. Mm. In reply to that, Gallant of the ACLU said to me, "We were hoping to get a serious, professional response from the U.S. government. This was not a serious response."
Has the government said what happens to these people next?
It says they'll be held at Guantanamo only temporarily until it can find other countries to take them. But Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem acknowledges that could take a long time. And we know from having sent suspected terrorists to Gitmo after 9/11 that some of those prisoners have never been allowed to leave,
right,
even ones who've been cleared for release. But DHS told us it will be ramping up the tempo of plane loads of migrants arriving at Guantanamo soon.
NPR Sasha Pfeiffer, thank you.
You're welcome.
Flowers and chocolates on Valentine's Day are fine, but sometimes you want to try something a little different. Planning a romantic getaway or writing a heartfelt poem. Maybe declaring your love on a billboard. But sometimes classics are classics for a reason. We asked NPR listeners to tell us about a grand Valentine's Day romantic gesture that did not quite go as planned.
My name is Clara Stallman Rader, and I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia. My Valentine's fail is when I got my boyfriend a whale-watching trip for Valentine's Day, which also happens to be his birthday. He loves whales, but as soon as we got on the boat, he got terribly seasick, and it was super cold, and it was raining sideways the whole time, and we didn't even see any whales. But he remembers it fondly as one of his favorite Valentine's Day adventures.
I'm Andrew Richard of North Virginia. In college, my girlfriend's parents went through her room and threw away her prized My Little Pony collection. And I was ecstatic when I finally found her favorite at a yard sale. She opened it and was immediately upset. The one I found didn't exactly match the one from her childhood. How was I supposed to know My Little Ponies can have the same name but different colors?
Scott Buchanan, Green Lane, Pennsylvania. Got my wife a nose hair trimmer. Actually, I got it for myself, but I gave it to her as a gift. But she didn't think it was funny. Not even a little funny.
Hi, my name's Melanie Peters, and I live in San Diego, California. For many years, my mom worked at a big insurance company, and every year during Valentine's Day week, there would be what she referred to as the parade of flowers. One year, I thought I'd do something special for her. So I ordered a bouquet from a top name brand flower delivery company. So imagine my surprise when I get this phone call from my mom. Hi, honey. Me? Did you get the flowers? My mom. Yes, but were they supposed to be dead? Luckily, our family has a great sense of humor. But every Valentine's Day since, I'll ask my mom, would you like some dead flowers?
Valentine's Day fails for Morning Edition listeners. There's always next year. This is NPR News.
Saturday Night Live celebrates its 50th anniversary with a live three-hour special on Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from some of the early cast members, Dan Aykroyd, Al Franken, who was one of the show's original writers before becoming a cast member, and writer Alan Zweibel, who talks about creating iconic sketches with Gilda Radner. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. When Beyoncé won the Grammy for Best Country Album, it was a sign to some that the genre might be becoming more inclusive. Michael Trotter Jr. had that thought when he and his wife Tanya were nominated in the Best New Artist category last year. They performed together as The War and Treaty.
In these kind of award shows, especially the Grammys, they give slots to genres to represent. War and Treaty and Jelly Roll represented country music in the Best New Artist category. Neither entity is the poster child for what a country artist should look and sound like. Yet we made such an impact to where country music wanted us to represent them.
Michael and Tanya Trotter continue to represent. Their brand new album as The War and Treaty is called Plus One, and it's a little bit of everything. Country, R&B, rock, bluegrass, gospel. It's a love letter to the music that shaped them and to each other. The way The War and Treaty crossed boundaries of genre and race made me wonder what they thought of Beyoncé's accomplishment at this year's Grammys. What do you think about what she said in her acceptance speech, where she said, quote, "I think sometimes genre is a code word to keep us in our place as artists."
I think that artists keep themselves in their place. I grew up listening to Celia Cruz, to Leontine Price, gospel music, R&B music, pop music. My vocabulary of music led me to getting a classical music scholarship. And I think that, yes, there are barriers because industries work with genres, but as an artist and as a creative, you have to do what you want to do. And as she said when she was releasing the record, that was a Beyoncé record for her. It wasn't a country record. So she made that declaration very early on of what it is.
One of the greatest creators who ever lived was Duke Ellington. And when someone interviewed him about him being a jazz musician, he was quickly offended. And he said, "I am not a jazz musician. I am a musician. I am an artist. Don't box me in." So I love that. And that's what's important.
You bring all sorts of different influences into your music. But one example of how you're bringing the gospel tradition to what Nashville's putting out these days is "Can I Get an Amen?"
Sunday morning, she's a bona fide preacher, laying hands all over me. Monday morning, she's a certified.
"Can I Get an Amen" is just an opportunity I get to brag on how beautiful and stunning and absolutely fabulous my wife is inside and out. It's about love for my family. It's about love for my country. I talk about dog tags swinging from my neck. I am a wounded war veteran. I served our country, United States Army. It's just a bragging song. We get to kind of like pop our collars a little bit there.
Well, as you alluded to, Michael, part of that song alludes to your, I guess it's an ongoing fight against PTSD. And you mentioned you spent some time in the Army, served in Iraq, and that the healing has been part of your music too. Tell me more about that. Why is it such an important theme in your music?
Yes, well, first thing, it's PTSD is something we deal with as a family. So I'm very proud of my wife and our family for that. I'm very proud of my service, but there are some scars that happen and some bumps and bruises you get along the way. I would not trade it for anything.
Let me go to another song on the album, Skyscraper. It starts with these provocative lyrics.
They said I'll never be nothing. No, they said I ain't got what it takes. Just a fat man with a fat chance. But I don't mind eating my piece of cake.
Okay.
That's right. I was very hungry that day.
What inspired that one?
When I joined the military, I weighed 197 pounds. When I came home, I was close to 400.
Ooh, okay.
That's the weight of depression. That's the weight of trauma. That's the weight of failing. And when I met my wife, I told her I was a failure. I told her I was nothing. I had nothing. I didn't know how to get to the something that I knew I could be. And what she did was she turned around and told me what she saw in me, which caused me to go look in the mirror and realize that I'm only studying the weight, and it's time to let it go. No one knows what it took to create that beautiful skyscraper you see in New York. We only marvel at the end result, but we don't pay attention and give much credence to the process because it hurts, it's ugly, it's dirty. There's some scrapes and scratches and bruises and bleeding, but there's a skyscraper.
The blood in the dirt.
Tanya, I'm going to ask you this. How do the two of you write songs together? Or maybe the better question is, how do you write songs together and still stay married?
Well, this is not going to be something that is like professional or it sounds great. Michael can start a song. He'll be at his piano. He'll be laying in the bed. And I am like the Tasmanian devil cleaning up my house at the same time. And he's throwing out lyrics. I'm listening to lyrics. I'm saying, no, change that as I run in and out of the room. So it's very different. You know,
begrudgingly, I'll change it up. Yeah, she's always correcting my word.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, your new album is scheduled to be released on Valentine's Day.
Woo!
Yes. We're talking to you ahead of the holiday, so I'm going to ask, any special plans? Or is it a secret?
No, there are special plans, yeah. Actually. We got a whole beautiful evening planned on Valentine's Day. We're actually doing a program at the Grand Ole Opry. We're hosting it and performing songs from our album, but also we're singing some famous classic country duets.
Yeah.
And then after that, we have an after party at Nashville Palace,
yeah,
one of the staples, the line dancing staples.
That's right.
So we're going to have some fun. We're going to party
it up.
We're
going to take our shoes off and have some fun.
And you know, you can't wait to take them heels off.
You couldn't just be regular and do chocolate and roses.
No.
Okay, I see how we're doing. Okay, putting everybody else to shame. Okay. That is Michael and Tanya Trotter. They are The War and Treaty. Their new album is called Plus One. Michael, Tanya, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you,
thank
Michelle.
You. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
This love is on fire.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has been making changes at breakneck speed, and he's been using emergency powers to do so.
This time, the Trump administration is much more confident and much more emboldened.
I'm Elsa Chang. Hear more about the emergency powers that Trump has been using and the very few checks and balances on them on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Hamas says it will release three Israeli hostages tomorrow as part of its ceasefire agreement with Israel. The three include an American citizen and a Russian citizen. In exchange, Israel will release hundreds more Palestinians. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, a dispute over these latest releases had threatened to derail the ceasefire deal in Gaza.
American Sagit Dekel-Chen is among the hostages to be released tomorrow. In exchange, Hamas expects Israel to release 36 Palestinians convicted for deadly attacks against Israelis and to release more than 300 Palestinians arrested in Gaza during the war. Earlier this week, Hamas had said it would delay the hostage release, alleging ceasefire violations by Israel, which Israel denied. The dispute was resolved. Keith Siegel, an American hostage freed this month, credited President Trump with his release.
President Trump, you are the reason I am home alive. Your leadership and strength will ensure the agreement is honored by all sides.
Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Efforts to negotiate an end to Russia's war in Ukraine are expected to be a major focus today in Germany when Vice President Vance meets with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. They'll be speaking on the sidelines of a security conference in Munich. This is NPR News from Washington. Nearly a dozen states in the U.S. with abortion bans are reporting few to zero abortions in 2023. That was the first full year after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. As Sarah Varney with KFF Health News reports, many doctors and researchers say the state's official records are false.
Arkansas and South Dakota report zero abortions in 2023, in Idaho, 5, and in Texas, 60. That's a steep drop from 50,000 pregnancy terminations in Texas in 2021. On the ground, doctors say they are doing abortions to save women's lives, and research groups have documented many telehealth abortions in these states. Ishan Mehta from Common Cause, a nonpartisan public interest group, says state officials need to dig deeper.
For better or worse, government data is the official record. You're not just reporting data, you are feeding into an ecosystem that is going to have much larger ramifications.
Mehta says that includes a further erosion of public trust and ill-informed legislation.
That's Sarah Varney with KFF Health News. Retail sales in the U.S. dropped sharply last month. The Commerce Department says sales fell nearly 1% in January from December. Economists suspect cold weather in the South and wildfires in California may have contributed to the drop-off. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Over the past 3 weeks or so, the Trump Justice Department has made a series of personnel moves that have rattled the institution. That includes targeting prosecutors and FBI personnel who worked on the January 6th Capitol riot investigation. A key figure in these efforts has been a top department official appointed by Trump, Emil Bovee. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has some reporting about Bovee's own role in the January 6th investigation, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
Let us start with Emil Bovee. What can you tell us about him?
So Bovee worked for many years as a federal prosecutor in New York and then moved over to the criminal defense side. And he's probably best known
for working as President Trump's personal attorney in several of Trump's recent criminal cases. That includes the two federal cases that were brought by special counsel Jack Smith. But after Trump won the election, he tapped Bove to serve in a top Justice Department role, a role that didn't need Senate confirmation. So since Trump's inauguration, Bove has been the acting number two official in the Justice Department. And in that role, he has spearheaded a lot of the personnel moves that have, as you mentioned at the top, rattled the Justice Department since Trump's inauguration.
So tell us more about what he's done.
Well, he's forced the transfers of several senior career officials. These are non-political folks, put them on an immigration enforcement task force. Many of those officials left the department instead of doing that. He's had a hand in firing more than a dozen prosecutors who worked Capitol riot cases. He's also fired 8 senior FBI officials and demanded and now has in hand a list of the names of all FBI personnel who worked on January 6 cases. Now, the Justice Department says it needs the names in order to review the agents' conduct to see whether they weaponized the FBI for partisan reasons in the Capitol riot probe. A lot of people at the FBI, though, saw that as a possible prelude to mass firings for, they say, retaliatory purposes. Now, I've been talking to former colleagues of Bove's from his days as a federal prosecutor in New York, and they have been really troubled by the hostility that he has shown for the Capitol riot investigators and prosecutors, in part because he himself, they say, worked January 6 cases.
Well, say more about that. What exactly did he do on the Capitol riot investigation?
Well, at the time of the riot, he was the co-chief of what is now called the National Security Unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. I spoke with 2 former colleagues of his. One was a prosecutor, the other a top FBI agent in New York. And they told me that Bove led efforts by federal prosecutors there to help the FBI aggressively investigate, identify, and arrest Capitol rioters in the New York area. His former colleagues say that Bove was aggressive in his work on January 6th. They also say he never voiced any reservations about the investigation and what they were doing. Here's Christopher O'Leary. He was a top counterterrorism agent in the FBI's New York field office at the time.
At no point did I ever hear of AMO or anybody else express concern about these investigations and these arrests that we were making because they were not concerning. They were like any other case that we worked as investigators and professionals.
Now, the former prosecutor who worked with Bove said that if the Justice Department were to make a list of prosecutors who worked January 6 cases the way that the department has of FBI agents, that Bove's name would be on that list. Now, I asked the Justice Department about this disconnect between Bove's aggressive approach investigating January 6 back then and his hostility towards it now. The department did not respond.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
It was 4 years ago this week that a devastating power failure left millions of people in Texas freezing in their homes for days. Hundreds of people died. Since then, state officials say they've improved the Texas power grid. But as Mose Bouchel from member station KUT reports, new challenges have also emerged.
This is a tough time of year for Minnal Shaw and her family. In February 2021, their elderly mother, Manjula, died after the power went out in their Austin home. As the temperature stayed below freezing for days, the family tried to keep her warm. They ultimately called an ambulance, but Manjula succumbed to hypothermia at the hospital.
Just the other day, I was sleeping and I woke up and then, you know, of course, I started thinking of my mom because this is the time when it happened. And, you know, you're questioning yourself, well, what could you have done more? And you always kind of get into that mindset, well, did I do enough?
Since then, she says everyone in her neighborhood is better prepared for emergencies. Many have bought home generators. Still, they get nervous when a winter storm comes in.
Well, it's just a little anxiety that, you know, hopefully the power doesn't go away this time.
To calm people's fears, state leaders point to the growth in power generation since the blackout. At a speech this month, Texas Governor Greg Abbott touted a public fund that gives incentives for companies to build natural gas power plants that could deliver 10,000 megawatts to the state.
That's enough to power more than 2 million homes.
But there's a catch. Texas operates its own grid with no major connections to neighboring grids. That means the work of keeping pace with fast-growing energy demand in the state is a priority most every legislative session. Just this week, the state grid operator reported that energy reserves may drop low enough to threaten grid reliability in extreme scenarios by 2026.
We must add more power this session to better fortify our grid.
With energy demand expected to skyrocket here, thanks to population growth, an energy-hungry oil and gas sector, and a boom in data centers, It's tricky for energy analysts to answer everyone's big question since the blackout. Is the grid fixed?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a fun one.
Joshua Rhodes is an energy research scientist at UT Austin. He says after the blackout, Texas lawmakers put in rules to winterize power plants to keep them running in the cold. The state power grid has also seen a boom in solar that's helped meet peak demand, especially in the summer, and a boom in utility-scale energy storage that helps year-round.
Texas didn't do it for an energy transition reason at all, but we just made it easy to build things here, and so people started building things here.
In the last week, four energy analysts told me Texas has faltered in other ways. The state has not improved energy efficiency standards since the blackout. Lawmakers have rejected joining up with neighboring power grids. Beth Garza is an Austin-based energy consultant. She says while state leaders want to build more gas power plants, that takes time, and they've not increased oversight to ensure gas supply to those plants.
And there doesn't seem to be a political appetite to address that aspect of the gas industry here in Texas.
In the end, the only true test of whether the Texas grid has improved may be another massive winter storm like the one in 2021. With severe cold fronts hitting the state more frequently, that's not something Minnell Shaw, the woman who lost her mother in 2021, wants to be around for. When I called her to catch up, she said she was actually heading out of state for a reunion with old friends.
I am in Dallas Airport right now on my way to Fort Lauderdale.
She says at first they talked about meeting in Texas, but then she thought, what if a winter storm comes and knocks out the power?
We just couldn't take that chance.
So they decided to spend February in Florida instead. For NPR News, I'm Moz Bouchel in Austin.
This is NPR News.
We'll look at the nationwide push to improve learning by restricting phones in schools. Next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. The Czech government just saved $1.2 million on a dam project, and they have beavers to thank for it. Drafted in 2018, the would-be barrier was meant to protect the river south of Prague and its endangered crayfish population. But while the humans fought over land rights, beavers in the area built the dams themselves. Researchers suspect the rodents were motivated by fear of predators. The new wetland is twice the size of the one the humans had planned. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's Valentine's Day. Hopefully you knew that already. And you know it's one of the biggest days for chocolate. If it's on your shopping list, chances are you're seeing higher prices. That's because the cost of cocoa beans has been going nuts for more than a year. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
How bad is the cocoa crunch?
It's been pretty dramatic for us.
Alex Whitmore runs Taza Chocolate. It's a manufacturer in the Boston area.
Most of what we do is molded chocolate bars. We do traditional Mexican-style chocolate products, chocolate-covered almonds, chocolate-covered cashews, that kind of thing.
Cocoa is by far his biggest cost, and global cocoa harvests keep coming up short. These days, the bean costs more than several precious metals.
The cost of cocoa for us has almost tripled.
Taza makes dark chocolate, so Whitmore often pays a premium to get high-quality cocoa and a lot of it.
When cocoa prices went haywire, so did our whole business model.
Things went haywire because of problems in West Africa. Farmers there grow the majority of the world's cocoa supply. In fact, mostly in just two countries, Ivory Coast and Ghana. And several crop seasons have been hit by abnormal weather.
Too much moisture, followed by getting too hot and drying out too much.
David Branch is an agricultural industry analyst at Wells Fargo.
It's just the stress of the tree allows diseases to take over.
Changing climate patterns have been hard on cocoa trees, especially older ones, he says. Cocoa crops have declined for 3 years now, while the world craves more and more chocolate.
The deficit ended up the highest deficit in 60 years. That's a pretty big hole to climb out of.
The biggest shortage of cocoa in 60 years. In the financial markets, cocoa prices broke the all-time record around last Valentine's Day. And since then, the price has doubled. That's attracted lots of traders just trying to make a quick buck on the roller coaster, only making it worse. And chocolate companies are forced to keep up because they actually need the physical beans. Here's Whitmore.
The beans that people are using now were purchased in the first half of last year. And so some of those beans are starting to be really expensive.
And that's changing what we see on store shelves. Some companies that don't have to use chocolate, like bakeries, have focused more on non-chocolate flavors. Candy makers are pushing more sour and gummy treats. Kit Kat even tried to convince us chocolate is not the point.
What's your favorite part of a Kit Kat bar? The chocolate?
Nope, the inside.
It's launched several bars not fully dipped in chocolate, like Neapolitan and Cinnamon Toast. All the big chocolate brands, Nestle, Hershey, Mondelez, which makes Cadbury and Milka, they've raised prices. Whitmore at Taza had to do that too.
By almost 15%, and it's a possibility that we may have to increase again.
He says the good news is that pricier cocoa means more money for cocoa farmers to invest in their farms, make the cocoa bean supply more sustainable. Branch at Wells Fargo says more countries are stepping up. Ecuador, for example, has planted a ton of new trees, which means a lot more cocoa a few years down the road.
So we're going to see this ease. It just is not a very quick fix.
And so far, shoppers are still buying more despite higher prices because, unlike the global cocoa supply, chocoholics are all about that quick fix. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The educational bookshop in East Jerusalem is known beyond the city. Diplomats, journalists, and intellectuals that are Israeli, Palestinian, or from international backgrounds frequent the two storefronts. Here's one of the owners, Mahmoud Muna.
We are very famous for catering books that's suitable for visitors. We also have a very strong collection on Palestinian identity, which also Israelis find it very useful because these books are not easily found in the Israeli mainstream bookstores.
So there was uproar when the family-run bookstore's two storefronts were raided by Israeli police on Sunday for the first time in the 40 years they've been open. They detained Mahmoud and his nephew Ahmed. Many saw it as an affront to freedom of speech. I spoke with Mahmoud after his release.
Policemen came and showed us certificates that give them the right to search the place for materials that are insightful. I asked a question on what is the criteria to how you decide if something is inciting or not, and they said that they know their job. And within minutes, they started stacking every book that had the word Palestine, had a flag, had a map, had anything that actually you could judge it from the cover to be a political book on Israel-Palestine question. And they took them with me and my nephew to custody and to interrogation and investigation.
What was it like in custody?
We're kept in a very unhumane, unprofessional, unhealthy conditions, shoving and kicking and insulting from all types of prison guards and police guards inside this compound. There's no lights, there's no clock. I was in a cell with 10 people in a space of maximum 4 by 4 meters, and constantly being insulted and constantly being humiliated by the guards.
You said constantly insulting. Give me a couple things that you would hear people say.
It's too bad to say on national radio. By the way, everyone there was Palestinian. So the assumption was that all of us are terrorists, and they acted upon it.
And what's the status of the case now?
They had to comply with the court decision to release us on bail. Me and Ahmed are in house arrest for 5 days. And we are supposed to be away from the bookshop for another 2 weeks after that. The file is not closed, but we are released.
You said they took bags and bags of books, English and Arabic. I mean, can you describe some of the things they took?
They took a book that is about climbing in Palestine. It's a guide for climbing.
Like climbing like mountains?
Yeah, climbing mountains. They took a book that's actually a new book, had a table about anti-Semitism and discussion around anti-Semitism by a distinguished Jewish author. It was kind of a funny moment. They questioned George Orwell, 1984, and they were asking me questions and they flipped through it and they couldn't make up anything of it. And I actually asked, I told him, you don't know this book? And he said, no, I don't. And I said, well, if you don't know what is George Orwell, you are certainly doing the wrong job today.
I'm going to read you just part of the statement from the police. It says, as part of the investigation, detectives encountered numerous books containing insightful material with national Palestinian themes, including a children's coloring book titled From the Jordan to the Sea. The suspects, both in their 30s, were transferred for questioning. When you hear that, what's your reaction?
Well, first of all, they're factually wrong on my age because I'm not on my 30s, unfortunately. I'm in my 40s. And if they can get my age wrong on my ID card, then that says it all, really. The books are of a natural Palestinian thing? Yeah, maybe. Sure. There's nothing to apologize about this.
Palestinian nationalist nature. Various inciting materials of a Palestinian national.
Well, very insightful, no. But books that present the part of the Palestinian story? Sure. We also have books that present part of the Israeli story as well. Sure. That's the actually recipe for having a good bookstore. It's important to say this is not my personal wish list of a house library. This is a bookstore that present different voices along different political lines for different readership to read things that they know and things that they don't know. This is what a good bookstore is.
When I asked what happens next, Mahmoud's brother Murad, who spoke to us from the bookstore, jumps in.
The bookshops are open. Yesterday we got a customer who came specially from Tel Aviv to say, I am ashamed of my country, what they did for you. The solidarity that we get from the local community and the international community just make us more strong.
I mean, I want to reiterate what Murad is saying. It's precisely at this moment when you see very little hope coming from government. It's the people, as people worldwide, that has to act and has to fill that gap and take on responsibility and show active solidarity. But for us, we wanted to create a departure point for this. That's we kind of hopefully mark an end for political persecution and for trying to continue to shrink this cultural spaces that we feel and we think that it is part of the Israeli policy in the recent years.
Thank you both so much, Mahmoud, Murad. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Israeli police did not respond to a request for comment about the conditions of Mahmoud's detention.
Different subject here. Layla, you ever watch YouTube?
Michelle, am I living under a rock?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You're a busy lady. But okay. YouTube turns 20 today.
Oh.
In 2005, three former employees of PayPal launched a brand new domain that they thought would host a dating website. The slogan was Tune In, Hook Up.
Ew. I'm not sure about that name. What happened to it?
Okay. Well, the co-founders, Steve Chen, Chad Hurley, and Javed Karim, could not get anyone to use it.
What a shocker.
I know, right? So they made the first YouTube video themselves. It's of Kareem facing the camera, 19 seconds. It's titled, Me at the Zoo.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. And cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks. And that's cool.
And while they didn't get the dating site they had envisioned, in the process, they did create a platform where anybody with an internet connection could upload and watch videos.
So back then, what did people do with this newfound ability to have their own place to share things with the world?
Well, the same as what they're doing with it today, really. I mean, they post videos and music, but, you know, tutorials, interviews, all the things. In 2006, Google bought YouTube for more than $1.6 billion, and today it is the second most visited site in the world after Google search.
Okay, so Michelle, do you happen to know which video has the most views ever on YouTube?
Oh, man. Okay. Do we really want to do this to people so early in the morning? Okay, sorry, you ask, so here you go.
Oh, no. Now this is going to be in my head all day.
I tried to warn you. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
In the orchard lives in my memory, 'cause it reminds me of my pappy.